For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so we're going to start this study of the book of Daniel. And I call this first teaching Kings and Teens, because it starts out with Daniel as a teenager and three of his friends. And what we're going to see is a level of character in these people that's pretty phenomenal. And the events in Daniel's life were around like 605 B.C. to around 530 B.C., so around 70 years of this period in what, the 6th century B.C. Part of this book is a historical study about his life and his friends and some of the things that happened to them and their lessons that we learn from that. But the thing that's most prominent and well known about the book of Daniel is the prophecy. And biblical prophecy looks at very specific foretelling of the future, and we see that in the book of Daniel. The other thing that's real important about Daniel is to understand the book of Revelation, which is the New Testament apocalypse, or looking towards the end. You need to understand the imagery as it's put forth in the book of Daniel. So over the next couple months, we're going to get into those passages too. Now, the authorship and the date of Daniel is something that's very controversial. What I'm saying is that this book was written in the 6th century B.C. Now, the prophecies are so specific, particularly the book of Daniel, these prophecies are so specific. For example, it says in Daniel 8, when Jody Keir is going to start next week, and there's kind of this framework that talks about the kingdom, starting with Babylon. Then after Babylon, there were the Medians, and then the Persians, followed by that, then the Greek Empire, followed by the Roman Empire. Now, it's so specific, written in around 600 B.C., these prophecies that predicted the kingdom of the Persians and the kingdom of the Greeks would come. And the Greek Empire, you know, Alexander the Great. You know, there was a movie about him. Then there's the Spartans. And so we know some ancient history just because we love our cinema, right? But Alexander the Great, he was the conqueror of the Greek Empire. And when he died, the empire was split into four sections. All of these historical events are explicitly predicted in the book of Daniel. Now, if you don't believe in God, then what do you have to do? You have to look at the book of Daniel and say, no, it was written after the fact. It was written during the 2nd century B.C., the so-called Maccabean era, and it's not predictive prophecy as it says it is, but it's a historical fiction. And so these are very controversial issues, and as I studied, if you're interested in this, there's a book by Gleason Archer called A Survey of Old Testament Introduction, where he goes through the critical views of Daniel. But the conclusions I've come to is based on the language that's used in it, it's ancient, the historical references, and also the fact that these books are referred to by extra-biblical writings like Josephus. And then finally, that fragments of the book of Daniel that refer to Daniel, we have those from the 2nd century B.C. And we have commentaries on those. That's in the so-called Dead Sea Scrolls. And if this was just historical fiction legends constructed in that era, then they would not be referred to by contemporaries as biblical material. It just wouldn't have time to generate a legend as a contemporary. So I think there's good evidence to argue for the case that Daniel was written when it says it was written, 6th century B.C., so it really does predict the future. And as we launch into Daniel chapter 1, what we get here is a background of this prophet Daniel. And this is when he and his friends are very young. So let's start right here in Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. During the third year of King Jehoiakim's reign in Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave him victory over King Jehoiakim of Judah and permitted him to take some of the sacred objects from the temple of God. So Nebuchadnezzar took them back to the land of Babylonia and placed them in the treasure house of his God. So what we find here is the big issue. I say that the battle lines are drawn here. Because what you have is you have King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. Now, in this period of the history of the Jews, as we think back, we had King David. Okay, that was around 1000 B.C. And then you had this nation that split into two. The northern was called Israel, the southern Judah. About 100 years before the events we're talking about here today, the northern kingdom was defeated by the Assyrians. Now Babylon comes in and they defeat the southern kingdom of Judah. And what does it say? It says, look at verse 1. He came to Jerusalem, he besieged it, and the Lord gave him victory. The Lord gave him victory. This was around 605 BC. But here's the tension, okay? Back in these days, when it came to a battle, a military campaign, it was not just about military, it was about theology. It wasn't just our soldiers trained by our guys to go out and fight. No, it was our gods fighting against their gods. In fact, a priest would always go with the army to offer sacrifices before a battle, for example. And so, what would be the interpretation? If you're a Babylonian and you went to Jerusalem, you besieged it, you won the victory, and what else happened? It says they sacked the temple, and it says they took back to Babylonia and they placed in the treasure house of his God. So they went right into Jerusalem, they knocked down the temple, they took the gold and these wonderful things out of the temple. They took them back to Babylon, and what'd they do? They put them in the temple of a pagan god. So who won? Their gods. The gods of Babylon. It looks like they won. But what did it say right there in verse 1? Who let them win? What's it say? God let them win. You think, wait a minute. Why would God let them win? Well, God told these people. You can go back into Deuteronomy 25 when he gave them the law. And he says, you follow the laws. And the first law was this: you'll have no other gods before me. And he warned them. He said, if you go into that land and you get fat and sassy and you turn away from me and you start worshiping other gods, then I will bring curses upon you to the point that the promised land that I gave you will vomit you out. That's explicit terminology. It will puke you out. Why? Because it's sick. The land that I gave you is sick of the way that you're acting, and you will be vomited out. And so this is the vomiting process going on, folks. Babylonia, the king Nebuchadnezzar comes, he besieges the city, and he takes them, and it said, and we're told that they were locked in chains like a band of slaves, which they were at that point, and marched to Babylon, hundreds of miles. That had a purpose too. It would break the spirit of a people. And so if you're a person who's read the scriptures, like the people who would be reading this and thinking, okay, now they're thinking, all right, now wait a minute, wait. God let them do this, but what did God promise? Well, he promised, he made this covenant with Abraham back in Genesis chapter 12, and he says, I will make you a great nation, and all the nations of the world will be blessed through you. And then he comes to David about 400 years before this, and he says, listen, there is going to be one of your heirs that will sit on the throne in Jerusalem forever. This Messiah, this anointed one. And so now you're here and you're, as a Jew, you're looking at this, you're like, oh, well, what do you, I mean, we're totally defeated. The temple has been destroyed. The palace has been destroyed. Our king is gone. The gods of Babylon seem like they've won. What's going on here? And so it's in this midst of an apparent total defeat of Israel that Daniel comes in here. And we're going to see what is going to happen to the people of God in this situation. What's going to happen? So let's see what happens to Daniel. Look at, we'll read 3 through 5. It says, Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, I guess that's how you say it, his chief of staff, to bring to the palace some of the young men of Judah's royal family and other noble families who had been brought to Babylon as captives. Select only strong, healthy, and good-looking young men, he said. Make sure they are well-versed in every branch of learning, are gifted with knowledge and good judgment, and are suited to serve in the royal palace. Train these young men in the language and literature of Babylon. The king assigned them a daily ration of food and wine from his own kitchens. They were to be trained for 3 years, and then they would enter the royal service. So he comes to his chief of staff. He says, okay, find the best young men, educate them well. Why? We want them to serve in the palace, feed them well, and this is going to go on for 3 years. Now, think of this. He says, I want you to find the best. Go find the royal family and others like that, and you bring them in, and what are they going to do? They're going to educate them in the literature and the ways of Babylon. They are going to bring them into the palace. I just raised this question. What's the purpose of this education? Here's brainwash, enculturate, assimilate. Yeah. I mean, this makes total sense, right? I mean, I guess one way you could deal with a population is genocide. People have done that before. They weren't into genocide. Why? Well, these people were valuable to them. I mean, back then, how did you get things done? You didn't hire a bobcat to, you know, dig, you'd get slaves. All right? And so these are valuable commodities to keep around. So how is it that you're going to keep these people under your thumb? Well, you're going to take the best, most influential among them. They know their culture. They know their language. And what are you going to do? Well, you're going to Babylonianize them. You're going to make them a Babylonian, right? And here they brought them in, and they picked the cream of the crop. And just think, if you were one of these teenagers, and that's what these guys were, they were young men. That means they were probably like 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old men. They bring them in. These guys had just marched to Babylon in chains, in rags. Their friends and family are probably serving in the fields, mining, domestic servants, all kinds of menial tasks. Their spirit has been broken as a people. And now, you've got a new job opportunity. Wow. You get to go live in a palace. Eat filet mignon or the best wine. I mean, here you are, a 12-year-old kid. You're getting the best wine. Nice. You know, they're gonna treat me well here. And what an education. What an opportunity. And you know, if you're a parent, and I'm gonna talk some about parents and how we approach this, but here's what we're thinking. What's the best thing for these kids? What's the best thing for them? Is it best for me to succeed in this sort of a way? Is this what's going to be good for me as a person? Is this what's going to be best for my future? You see, what they wanted to do is this. They wanted to strip those men of any sense of a spiritual center. Any sense that they were God's people sent here to carry out the plan that God had ordained for their people for the future. You see, that's the question here. Will the people of God sustain the mission that He had given them to do, or will they assimilate into this culture and take that culture to the top? That's the tension that these guys face. And so, you know, they went on with this process. Look at verse 6 and 7. It says, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were four of the young men chosen, all from the tribe of Judah. The chief of staff renamed them with these Babylonian names. Daniel was called Belteshazzar. Hananiah was called Shadrach. Mishael was called Meshach. And Azariah was called Abednego. When I told this story about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to my kids, I'd say, and to bed we go. It's a good story. We'll get to that story. But listen, all three of these names that these guys had, or the four, were names that honored God. Their Jewish name. The L is a short for God, and it's incorporated into their names. Each of these names honors God. And you know what the chief of staff did? He changed their name in almost a mocking way, that changed it to honor a pagan deity that was worshipped in Babylon. See, and names meant more then than they do now. What they would conclude then with this name, and those who contacted, that these are Babylonians now. Their allegiance is to the gods of Babylon. Now they really didn't have much choice in this matter. They decreed these new names for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But there was a stand that they could still take, and that's what we find next. Look at verse 8. It says, but Daniel was determined not to defile himself by eating the food and wine given to them by the king. He asked the chief of staff for permission not to eat these unacceptable foods. Now, here's where he decides. Okay, they want us to study the literature. They've renamed us. There's certain things here. But there is a line that I'm going to draw in the sand. And the line is this, not to eat the food. You're thinking, now wait a minute. Why? The food's good, man. What's wrong with the food? Well, here's the thing. In these pagan cultures, what they would do when they would bring an animal in, of course, you got to slaughter it to eat it. Well, what you would do is you would slaughter it in a way that it's offered as a sacrifice to the deities. And here's why that makes sense, if you believe in this deity, because the animal sacrificed to the deity, now the deity gives a blessing to this sacrifice, so that this food now is kind of spiritually supercharged. You know, you want to really get pumped up. You know, you want to eat this spiritually supercharged food. It's been sacrificed to this God. He blesses it. Now I eat it. Wow. I am better off for that. Same thing with the wine. They would offer it as a drink offering. And so what Daniel and his friends decide, we're going to draw the line here. Why? Well, because the first commandment is, you'll have no other gods before me. You shouldn't worship idols that I am going to provide for you. And so they decide, okay, when push comes to shove, we can learn about the customs of Babylon. We can be good students. We'll take these names. But our allegiance, our loyalty is to our God Yahweh alone. And we will not, I repeat, will not be party to the worship of idols. And so they say no to the food. That's why. And it says, now God, look at verse 9. Now God had given the chief of staff both respect and affection for Daniel. But he responded, I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has ordered that you eat his food and wine. If you become pale and thin compared to the other youths your age, I'm afraid the king will have me beheaded. Sounds like he had a difficult boss to please. Aren't you glad you don't have that fear when you go into work? My boss will have me beheaded. I guess that would keep you on task. Meet your quotas for the month. But here's the thing. It says here, too, that God had endeared Daniel to this guy, this chief of staff. And Daniel could have quit at this point and said, oh, okay. But he doesn't. Look at verse 11. It says, Daniel spoke with the attendant who had been appointed by the chief of staff to look after Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Please, test us for 10 days on a diet of vegetables and water, Daniel said. At the end of the 10 days, see how we look compared to the other young men who are eating the king's food. Then make your decision in light of what you see. The attendant agreed to Daniel's suggestion and tested them for 10 days. So what's Daniel's idea here? His idea is that, all right, listen, let's put God to the test. And this will be simple enough. I mean, how bad could we really get in 10 days? This is a 3-year training period. You know, if we're looking bad, we look pale, we look weak after 10 days, we'll just call it off. We'll just call it off. Why can he say that? Because he knows. God has revealed to him this plan, and he's hatched it here. And look what happens. Look at 15. Down in 15. It says, at the end of the 10 days, Daniel and his three friends looked healthier and better nourished than the young men who had been eating the food assigned by the king. So after that, the attendant fed them only vegetables instead of the food and wine provided for the others. So, you know, what we have here is something that could be degraded to saying that it's better to eat vegetables than meat. That's not the message here, folks. I mean, I think vegetables are good, and probably some of us could eat a lot more vegetables and a lot less meat. But folks, that's not the message here. Why was the meat bad? It's a spiritual reason. It's because it was committed to idols. It meant that taking this in, I believe that the strength for my life and my future will be energized by these idols, and that will make it good. And what did Daniel and these guys say? They said, no. What's good, what will energize my life, what will give me a future and a hope is the presence of the Almighty God. And I want to follow Him. And if it means that I'll turn down a filet mignon and a vintage wine, I'll turn it down because that's not what I need. I don't need that. I need the power of God at work in my life. So that's where they staked out their claim. And I think it's so important here, folks, to set this stage in Daniel 1 like the scriptures do, because there's going to be a lot of things that happen in their lives where this gets tested. Life is a test. And they get tested. And we see how they bear up under those tests. But what laid the foundation for this life is their allegiance. Their allegiance. Where they decided they would stake their claim. Look what happened then. It says that God gave these four young men an unusual aptitude for understanding every aspect of literature and wisdom. And God gave Daniel the special ability to interpret the meanings of visions and dreams. And so God's giving them something here. An unusual aptitude. You think, why would God do that now? Well, you know, here we have a special situation. These slaves turned trainees in the court of the king of Babylon. They have a very unique role and a possibility for their future that no one else really could have had. And what God did is He chose these guys. He found they were faithful young men, that they wanted to follow him. They were willing to put aside the food and follow him. They didn't want to follow idols. And now what he's doing is he's moving in now, and in this way of giving them a special understanding and aptitude, he's helping them learn. And look what happens then. When this is all over, when the training period ordered, that was 3 years, remember? By the king was completed, the chief of staff brought all the young men to King Nebuchadnezzar. That's not just these four, it means the whole training class. Who knows how many that was? The king talked with them, and no one impressed him as much as Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the royal service. How about that? So here are the Jewish boys, slaves turned viceroys. They're in his kingdom. They're his special advisors. Think of the impact that they could have now. And it's an impact that's generated out of their commitment and their love for God. Look at verse 20. It says, whenever the king consulted them in any matter requiring wisdom and balanced judgment, he found them 10 times more capable than any of the magicians and enchanters in his entire kingdom. Daniel remained in the royal service until the first year of the reign of King Cyrus. That means a long time. He remained in the king's service, so the king trusted him. So what we have here is effective servants. They were effective to the king, but ultimately they were effective to God. Because here they had this opportunity in this pagan world to bring in God's perspective. And who knows what kind of laws they might have helped institute that could have taken care of the poor and other people. We just don't know. We don't have that kind of detail. But we know that here were men of God serving the king. And so, you know, this whole story raises some very important points of application, I think. Because there are a couple lessons. The first I see is this. That they lived as lives where they were part of the culture, but they were aware of it. And what do we mean by this? Well, they were aware of it in the sense that they could see that there were certain lines, certain things that they could sort of accommodate to that weren't dangerous spiritually, but then there were certain lines that they thought, we can't cross over. How was it they decided again? Remember, they decided, let's not eat the food, but we'll study the literature. Why? Well, I mean, that literature, you know what? That was all religious stuff. It was probably they studied astrology, they studied spell casting, they studied a lot of crazy stuff. And yet they decided they were going to do that, but they weren't going to take the food. Why? Because that was a clear connection with the worship of idols. You know, they could study the literature without being bought into it. That's the difference here. Here's what Jesus, when he prayed for his disciples, look what he said. He says, I'm not asking you, he's praying to the Father, God the Father, to take them out of the world, but to keep them safe from the evil one. They do not belong to this world any more than I do. You see, this is the mentality that I think we want to strive toward or think about. Jesus is saying, all right, God, you don't take them out of the world. The world is, so in the Babylonian thing, that's living in the Babylonian culture. What we could have thought is, well, what we need to do is build our own ghetto and put a wall around it and keep our Jewish people here so we can preserve our culture. You know, that's the way some people look at the Christian faith. That what we have to do is put it in a walled compound so that these influences can't come in and break up our belief system. And that's not what Jesus said. He says, I'm not asking you to put them in a compound. I'm not asking you to take them out of the world, but keep them safe from the evil one. There is an evil spiritual influence personalized in this world. The Bible calls him Satan. And he has a personal agenda against any of God's followers. It says, keep him safe from the attacker. But then look at verse 16. And this is where we see these guys get distinguished. He says, they don't belong to this world any more than I do. You see, this is the mentality that brings us freedom. Because all the time we can think, well, you know, should I do this? Shouldn't I do this? Should I eat this food, not that food? Should I study this literature, not that literature? Here is the principle that he's working on here. Where is my home? Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. Where was their home? Was it Babylon? No. Their home was Jerusalem. Wasn't it? That's where their temple was. They knew that was the center of worship geographically, but they weren't there. So in their heart of hearts, in their spirit, their home is with their Father in heaven. You know, and that's what Jesus is getting at here. He says that we can be in the world, we can be immersed in a culture in a way, and yet not consider that to be our own. Our home is elsewhere. That's why Paul says that we're to have the mentality of a sojourner, of a traveler, that we're just passing through. You see, and if you're just passing through, then the things that draw us in and make us believe that this place is permanent, we see through that. We realize that the things that are offered to me in this lifetime that are here and gone, they're not mine. And I can have a loose grip on that. Why? Because I know it's going to be gone when this is over. That Jesus says, lay up treasure in heaven, not treasure on earth. There's spiritual realities that trump the physical realities. And that was the mentality that these guys had. And so when they looked at being part of the culture and aware of it, there are just a few points here. One was their allegiance. Their allegiance was to their father, not to the gods of Babylon or to the king of Babylon. They had a loyalty to him on one hand, but they knew there was a line. And I think that's what the challenge for all of us is. What is the line, you know, that we're not going to step over? What's going to guide our moral decisions and our job and that sort of thing? It's our allegiance to God. In the book of Joshua, he summed it up like this. He says, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. I mean, we all serve somebody. We serve somebody or something. He says, we will serve the Lord. The second one point here is that they were engaged with the culture. How do you think they were chosen as the top four guys of the class? You think they loafed on their homework? Didn't go to class, slept in, didn't work hard, didn't meet their goals. No. These guys were totally engaged. In the New Testament, Paul puts it like this. He says, do your work heartily, from the heart, as if you are serving God. You see? And so there's a thought here that when I go to work, when I go to school, when I study, when I do these things, that it's not just about me doing this thing. It's about me serving God. Being His presence in this workplace, in this classroom. And you know what happened? Because they had this kind of an education, because they were able to shine in this way, they had a voice for God. And you see that. You see that today in our culture, that there are certain people, because of the stands that they've taken, because they have excelled in certain ways, that they have been able to speak for God in ways that others couldn't. And their influence, they were engaged in their culture, but it was in a way that was redeeming. In other words, they brought good. They brought good to the places that they were. In Philippians, here's what Paul says. He says, do everything without complaining and arguing so that no one can criticize you. Live clean, innocent lives as children of God, shining like bright lights in a world full of crooked and perverse people. I'm sure there's no crooked and perverse people here. We all are, in a way, crooked and perverse. But what's he saying? He's saying that we can shine. We can be a redeeming influence, shining as lights in the midst All right. So they were part of the culture, but they were aware of it. They made a difference. They knew where their allegiance was. They were engaged in a level. They did their work like they were serving God. And yet their focus was they wanted to be a redeeming influence. That's good. Well, you know, as I thought about this, the other thing I made me think about is these guys must have had some good parents behind them, or a good community that helped them form their spiritual values. Because here they are, they had all kinds of temptation to just forsake their past, take this Babylonian way, and go with it. And yet they didn't. And so I just thought, and this is just kind of some thoughts I had on parenting. And so let's just go with it. Thoughts on parenting. The Bible's super practical. So if you're not a parent here, maybe you will be, or maybe you've got that all behind you. I don't know, but bear with me. Here's what the world says your kid needs: self-esteem. That they need to have a good sense of self. And there's something true about that. But the truth is, in our culture, self-esteem has been totally overblown. Because the kid has become the center of the universe. Here's an example. I like myself. Okay, now, the idea here is if I can, and philosophically, the idea is if I can like myself, then I'll be a good person. I am brave. I'm loving. And so the idea here is that we convince someone that they're loving. You have much success convincing someone they're loving? How does someone become loving? They usually get taught to be loving. I'm polite. How does a kid learn to be polite? By telling them they're polite? No, I think the way a kid learns to be polite is because when they interrupt, you guide them and you realize. See, there's a way of thinking about kids. It's kind of the old Dr. Spock way, which he even repented of. And that is that everyone is basically good and you just draw the good out of them. Well, from a biblical standpoint, there's a goodness about people. It's because they're created in the image of God. But people have a wicked heart, including a kid. My youngest daughter, her first word was, no. And then when I'd say, you want to go out for lunch with Daddy? No, Daddy is yucky, yucky, yucky. You know? And you know, and you just come to realize to get to be polite, what they need to do is they need guidance. If they're impolite, you guide them. You say, no, you need to wait. And they interrupt you again, then they get a constant. No, you need to sit here, you know, for a timeout. Choose your thing. They need guided. They need instructed. They don't just need to be told that they are the most wonderful thing in the world, that you're special. In fact, there's a body of emerging literature today. There's a book called Generation Me, and then this author named Twenge wrote a follow-up on that, showing that the narcissism index in our young people is growing by the decade. Probably by the year. That means narcissism means being self-absorbed, thinking that the whole world revolves around me. I think it's a bad byproduct of the self-esteem sort of movement. I think instead of self-esteem, what our kids need to feel is a sense of security. Security that from a parent that I love you, that I'm not going to abandon you. And there's a whole spectrum from the time a kid is little until they're a teenager, how they feel secure. And really, for the littlest kids, the irony is they feel more secure if they know that there are boundaries that they have to be kept to. You see, the problem with the self-esteem, and the next one I get to is the idea that my job is to make my kid happy, is that anything that I would do that would make them unhappy, that I'll put that up here as the next one, is going to injure them somehow psychologically. And he's going to be unhappy if I say, no, you can't go over there and smash your sister in the head with your ball bat, okay? Maybe you didn't have those kind of problems in your house. And I mean it, okay? And there's going to be a consequence if you don't live. And but then if there's this turmoil that I have, well, that's going to make him unhappy, and somehow that's going to make him a worse person because he's not happy. And I think, no, wait. It's not that they need to be happy in that sense. They need to feel that there are certain boundaries, and my parents are going to help me learn what those are, and that's what's going to help them feel more secure, and ultimately, it's going to provide a context of a love for them, because love includes discipline. And I have juxtaposed to happy the sense of being holy. If the goal of parenting is to make a happy kid, it won't work. It's interesting. This was in Newsweek just about a month ago. There was an editorial written by someone writing about psychology, and they quoted someone from the... Anyway, it's about this whole idea of happiness as the goal of life. Happiness is never an outcome that you get as a goal. It's a byproduct. Happiness is always... It's a byproduct of living in a way, from my standpoint, that's following God. You know, when you put first things first, which is a relationship with God and following Him, the second things like happiness, joy, peace, those things come. So when I look at parenting, and I think what Daniel and his friends, his parents had in mind, I want these sons of mine to have the first priority that God is their God. And I want them to follow Him. And I think for all of us that are parents, this is kind of the challenge or the ideal that we got to decide. What is it that I want for my kids? What is it that's going to make them happy? Because, you know, there are a whole lot of things that are out there on the list. And a lot of times it revolves around when we look to the future that they're going to have a good career, that they're going to make a lot of money, and that's going to give them peace and joy. And I'm not saying that, you know, I want my kid to be a vagabond, you know, and never go to work or anything like that. But listen, when it comes down to it, when push comes to shove, what I want is I want my kid to want to follow God. And when he or she, I have a boy and two girls, if that's their first thing, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, the second things are going to flow from that. You know, and I don't care if he is the CEO of Microsoft, or maybe even better yet, Google. And if he's far from God, his life is going to suck. And I'll write that on a line for you. And if you think that your son or daughter being the CEO of a company and that's going to make their life good, please reconsider that. It won't. I mean, they may have, you know, all the accoutrements of life that seem to be really good. And on the surface, it'll look like they got it together. And then it might even reflect back on you and people say, wow, your son's the CEO of Google. Wow, you must be an awesome parent. You know, that's unfortunately what it comes down to for a lot of us. We're living vicariously through our kids. We want them to do something we didn't do, so we push them to do things that really just get the accolades of this world, of Babylon. Listen, man, this is so important. Because your kids are taking their cues from you. Holy, not happy. And here's the other thing, just to think about. When your kids are little, the time that you have the most opportunity to have an impact. A lot of people say the first 5 years are probably the most important. But I still think, you know, we can have an impact after that. But particularly as they get a little older and they get into this age when they're starting to make their own decisions, you know, as teenagers and that, basically they're making more adult decisions. You can't force certain things on them. I think your parenting needs to change. When they're little, they say, well, you know, they're a two-year-old, and they say, well, why can't I go out in the street? And it's like, you know, you're not going to reason, well, you know, those cars, there's inertia, and it's speed times mass equals inertia, and it'll, you know, you don't. It says you don't go out in the street because I told you not to, you'll get killed. You know, when somebody's a teenager, you aren't going to say, you don't do that because I said so. That's, you know, you talk to them, you reason with them. They're more, it's an adult conversation. But still, I think it's important for us that want our kids to have spiritual values is to encourage them strongly or maybe even mandate at certain points that they seek spiritual activity in their life and to prioritize that. A lot of times I see kids that have all kinds of time to do activities and dance lessons and piano lessons and horn lessons and football teams and basketball teams and this and this and this. And then when it comes the night for their Bible study, they're too tired or they got to get up early to go to a game or something and they don't go. I think that's a mistake. It's a mistake. You're teaching the wrong lesson. You're saying what's going to make your life good is to excel in this sport team or to excel at school. And I mean, I love sports. I played sports. I'm a jock kind of guy. And sports were good for me when I was in high school. It kept me out of trouble. I learned a lot of life skills. I think that's good. And yet, just like Babylon, there was a lot of good things to learn there, but there was a line to draw. You see, and that's what we have to pray for the wisdom to know where's the line to draw. There's something good about this, but then it can cross over into something that is, and I'll say it, could be bad. That academics, that sports, that anything out there could be bad if pushed to a certain limit. If that child of mine comes to the point where they believe this is what's going to make my life something, they've crossed over. And we can tell them that by just prioritizing those things by what we put in their schedule and we keep in their schedule. We say, do this, don't do that. Okay, you know, you're tired. You need rested up for the game. Yeah, blow that thing off. You know, your actions speak so loud they can't hear what you're saying. Think about that. What's the next one? It's just me. A lot of parents feel like, you know, it's me and my spouse, it's us. We don't really have any help, but I think that's a big mistake because really, parenting is meant to be a community effort, I think. They talk about a village to raise a kid. That's the way the scriptures. It's very likely that these boys in this story were raised, you know, they went to the synagogue. So they had all kinds of people that were giving them input and helping them grow. That's the beauty of having these home churches. And I would encourage you, if you got kids, talk about, man, I am so glad that I had people in my life. My kids are all out of the house now. Doesn't mean we're done. We still got a lot of problems. But that I have people that I can talk to, that'll pray with me, that I've cried with about problems that we've had in our family. And that's what you need. And besides that, what I think has really been helpful is, you know, as our kids have grown up, we've had Bible studies at our house. We had high school students in our house for like 12 years on Friday nights. We had high school boys group there. But the kids, who do you want your kids to look up to? Okay? Who do you want them to look up to? Who do you talk about as kind of your heroes and that kind of thing? And that's why I loved having meetings in our house and having people over to our house so they got to know. We went on vacation with friends. So they are connected with these people that are spiritual heroes. People that have put God first, they are the ones most connected. So, we purposely thought, we want these folks to be the role models our kids would want to follow. Community. Yeah. And then, of course, there's do what I say or watch what I do. Here's the problem. You have no choice on this one. Okay? You have no choice. Because it's never do what I say. It's always watch what I do. Your kids are intense students of your behavior. You know, for example, you know, I don't know how many times I've seen this kind of scene play itself out. So here, the family, you know, they're ready to go. The kids are playing. And mom or dad says, okay, let's go, Johnny. It's time to go. Johnny acts like he doesn't even hear. Okay, so 5 minutes later, all right, Johnny. You heard me. It's time to go. You know, you put the John Wayne voice on and the swagger. And the kid doesn't listen then. And then finally, you know, they come in and they scream, they stomp their feet, they kick the toy across the room. You heard me. Get ready to go. And the kid, you know, gets up and walks around. What has he been taught? He knows his parent. He knows that when he does not mean anything until he kicks the toy. Okay? When he kicks the toy, then I get up and I go and no problem. I've learned. I've studied my dad. You see, when we read this book, Laura and I, about parenting, it's called An Action Line. His action line is after he's hurt his foot on the toy. Then he'll do something about it. And what we all need to decide is, where do we want that to be? And I'm not saying that you got to be, rrr. It's just that when you say, okay, let's get ready to go, if they don't get ready to go, then you give them a consequence. Okay, time out, or you can't play next time, or, you know, something like that. But they know. Otherwise, you just teach them that, yeah, they don't mean business until this point. And so they're watching what you do. But beyond that, and I'll tell you, what I think, as far as watching you, the greatest gift you can give your kid is a life lived following Christ as first in your life. Because that's what they're watching. And they're looking at you, and they're drawing their cues. What matters to Dad? What's he put first? When he says the scriptures matter to him, do I ever see him reading the scriptures? When there's a problem, does he pull us together and we pray about it? Have I seen my parents engaged in this way? That's what's going to mold this young person's worldview. And so with that, there's the lessons I think we're getting out of Daniel. How we interact with culture, these guys, what a pressure they had to just kind of give in. And then these thoughts about parenting. So I'm going to stop right there.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.